Hi, I'm Brennan Schollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Donald Korb, OB, FAAO, of Korb & Associates in Boston, Massachusetts. Where did you grow up?
On planet Earth. I grew up in Boston.
What did your parents do?
My father was a physician and an academic, my mother was a voice teacher and a person who worked rehabilitating voices.
Was it their careers that got you interested in a medical field?
Not at all.
How did you get involved in optometry and research then?
Sort of by accident. That becomes quite involved, and it truly is an involved story. So I will simply try to encapsulate it in a few words. So I really decided that I wanted to be a physician, which is strange because my father was a physician, and I just told you that that didn't influence me, and it really didn't, but I saw an avenue to do a lot of good, perhaps, and I found it perhaps stimulating. But as life went on, I didn't like blood, and I didn't like certain other aspects of medicine, and not really knowing what I wanted to do, I thought that ultimately I'd have to make a living, so I would try to be an optometrist. And my mother, really knew an optometrist very, very well, and I went to him as a child, and he practiced in the same building, actually in the same suite as my father, and that resulted in my thinking about optometry. And after having been 2 years in pre-med and really not liking it, I thought optometry would be an area that I should investigate. So I went to optometry school. That's the long and the short of it.
So how did you get involved in optometry research?
Ever since I was a child, I was always interested in the why of everything, which made me very annoying. I asked the typical questions many children ask, and I received the typical answer. When you're older, you'll understand. That's not a question that should be asked at your age. And my father had an extensive library, and I pilfered into it, and I read some of the areas that perhaps I shouldn't have at a younger age. But what it did for me was it made me ask the question of, how did all this come about? Why did it come about? What is the relationship between theology, philosophy, and pragmatic behavior? What we do right now. And I unfortunately came across a book by Spinoza when I was probably 9 or 10. And that had a great influence on me because I recognized that he was a man who was so brilliant, and yet he was forced to work as a lens grinder all of his life. And perhaps his working in optics and being a lens grinder while having all these different interests made me understand that you had to do something to make a living. And my father always preached that. My father always preached, no matter what you do, do it well. But more importantly, do it so that you enjoy it. You have to like it. You have to have a passion for it. You have to be into it. So when I became an optometrist, I was also interested. And miraculously, I had it almost immediately. I was very, very fortunate in that I ended up in the office of the gentleman who had taught contact lenses, my professor in contact lenses in optometry school. And I ended up in his office, and he took me in, and ultimately I succeeded him. And all of a sudden I could see in a volume of patients, and I saw all the problems that existed. And I had several ideas as to perhaps how they could be solved. And one of them was to better map the cornea. Well, in Boston at the time, there was a company called Polaroid Corporation, the inventor of instant photography. And I learned that they had infrared film, and I discovered that we could actually take maps of the cornea with infrared film on a profile basis. So I went over there, and attempted to make a position for myself, which I eventually did. And shortly thereafter, I was more or less the head of ocular photography and oral photography and dental photography. And I was only out of school 24 months probably when that happened. And that really changed my life because all of a sudden I had the opportunity to see the research of this genius, Edward Land. And that is still with me. That experience is still with me.
Why don't more ODs conduct research?
Well, why should they?
Do you think it has more to do with costs, getting the right position, the fact that a lot of ODs, when they come out of college, are owing so much money?
Well, I think that's a very simplistic response, frankly. And I think it's the typical simplistic response that we never want to understand the multifactorial aspects of any situation that we're in. We want a quick answer. I think our society today is geared towards immediate gratification. We have to, it's very, very easy to ask questions of a colleague on the internet or text them. And the very question that you may ask may require hours of research on the part of the person who's attempting to respond. But we don't think of that because that's not our culture. So now let's stop for a minute and examine why I answered the being in debt is too simplistic. Because if you were given everything, do your neurons understand observation? Because if they don't, you won't be very good in research. Number two, do your neurons understand intellectual curiosity? And have they been trained that way? And if they haven't, woe is me. And number three, collaboration. Are you a person who can collaborate with others? Are you a person who in your own situation can, without saying, I'm the leader, please pay tribute to me. Are you a person who can work with others and have that person respect you? Are you a person who, if you had four or five pieces of fruit and you wanted to give one to your associate, could you give the piece of fruit that was unblemished? Or would you keep that one piece of fruit which was unblemished for yourself and provide the ones that had little pits in them and little blemishes to your beneficiary? Because if you couldn't, if that's not your persona, you probably will not be a great collaborator, and you probably will fail. If you want to do good research in today's world, you cannot have a big ego, or you must be able to suppress your ego. And another way to think from the time I've been a child is I borrowed this from somebody who I can't remember whom, it was many, many years. And that individual said, if the great maker, referring to a deity, if the great maker had the opportunity to redesign this situation, or if the great maker had the opportunity to correct this situation or take the next step or develop a medical technique or develop a new medicine or develop a new medical device, what would the great maker do? And that is the question that every researcher should understand, because it changes your way of thinking. There was some omnipotent power that could foresee what was happening, what would they do? What area would they go into? And I remember in 1970, I was sitting in a lecture, and this man went on and on and on about all the things that were wrong with contact lenses, with the new soft contact lenses, on and on and on with all of them. You didn't see as well, they hurt, maybe they made the eye red. Who knows what else they would do? He was just extremely negative. And as I was sitting there, guess what I said? I said, what would the great maker do to solve all these problems? And I thought, aha, the great maker would look at all of the species that the great maker has created. And he would look at the rabbit. And he'd see that the rabbit had a nictitating membrane. And the nictitating membrane is very thin. And it protects the eye. It's a third eyelid against the eye itself in a different manner than our external eyelids. And the great maker would say, people can't see because they're reading too much. And because they're myopic. And because they have other problems. What we'll do is we'll make a corrective device, not big and thick, but we'll make it thin. We'll make it as thin as that nictitating membrane. In fact, we'll try to make it only 2 or 3 or 4 cells thick. And I sat there, and I said, that's the answer. How simple this is. Well, it was. That was the answer. All modern contact lenses, when possible, are made essentially thin, 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 thin. Because there isn't room in the eye to put on a thick, thick one. I mean, that makes sense. It's it's so simplistic. And I went back and I said, how am I going to do this? And I said, I need 2 things. I need resources and I need people who know more than me in the areas that I need. So I had to develop a team. I had to collaborate. And I had to motivate people to do that. And the result was the first membrane contact lens, the first extended wear lens that worked in this country, and the grandfather of all modern contact lenses. And the name of it was the CSI lens. But that's how it worked. That's how it worked. But most people don't think that way.
You've been involved with founding 5 research companies, I think. When should researchers take their work out into the commercial sector?
Well, again, that depends. They may not have a choice, because how do you get the money to do research? Many of them are forced to take in investors and forced to take in venture capitalists, and they make those decisions. So the inventor or the founder doesn't even have a choice.
But if they did, under what circumstances should researchers take their work into the commercial sector?
Yeah, I'm trying to answer simply, but it's a complicated question. The first prerequisite is that it's good for society. It has to work. But usually the person who's done this is only interested in money. Either money to pay back what they owe because they've been involved with it, or because of the time they've spent on it without getting compensation, or any one of all the allied factors. So why don't we say philosophically, when should they bring it out? And they should bring it, any invention that can help people should be brought into the commercial field after it has had adequate testing to be certain that it will do no harm, number one. And number two, as the FDA says, that it's efficacious. All the great people I've ever worked with, and I've had an opportunity to work with the number one person in many different fields. I'm very, very fortunate. But they all say the same thing. It must be good for society, or have the potential to be good for society. Because until anything is out where it's fitted across the entire spectrum of the population, who are very genetically different, you have no idea of how it's going to work. And you have no idea what possible complications could be. As an example, almost all medications that are in use today have a preservative in them. And several of the preservatives are certainly not good. We're talking about the eye. And why do they exist? Because there's no other way of doing it, because the alternative is worse. You could get terrible infections and people could lose eyes. But now, after all these years, there's major efforts on the parts of many companies to bring out containers which have special features, so you don't have to have a preservative. But it takes a long, long, long time for someone to, quote, observe that there's a significant problem, get the data, believe it, and have the intellectual curiosity to move the project forward. Now, intellectual curiosity isn't enough, because to raise money, no one's going to spend millions and tens of millions and hundreds of million dollars on projects which have no return today. The answers are complex, and they're a mixture of the necessities of a capitalistic society to have someone receive an adequate return on their investment often enough so they will patronize the field, and all the other factors that are obvious and we've already discussed.
How do you balance time for patients and research?
Well, I think there's two pillars which you have to accept. The first is the probability is you're not going to have the income you would have if you didn't do research. So that's the first concept that you really have to accept. And the second concept you have to accept is you're going to be working a lot more than the standard 40 or 50 hour week. You're going to be working 60, 70, 80, 90 hours a week. And for years, I averaged 80 plus hours a week and sometimes much more. And you have to have a support team. You have to have a wife who will support that. You have to have a family that understands and will support that. And you have to be sure that what time you do have is spent very, very effectively with your family unit, or it will never happen. The days of doing significant research and seeing patients even half time are pretty well over. It's because everything is so more complex, it takes much longer, and we have to go much faster. But it's still all great. It's still wonderful.
So what keeps you in private practice then?
Well, private practice, again, if we go back to the pillars that we're talking about, observation, intellectual curiosity, and collaboration, if instead of seeing a patient, if you ask the question, is this optimal care? If it were myself who has that particular problem, would I be satisfied with the treatment that I'm providing to this patient? And just to give you an idea, when I first went into practice, I didn't know enough to know that I didn't know what I didn't know. But as my knowledge base increased and I did research in certain areas, all of a sudden one led to the other. So when I developed this wonderful contact lens, the only problem with the CSI lens was, like all lenses, some people could wear it wonderfully for 2, 3, 4 hours, and then it became scratchy and gritty. And then we learned that the lens was dry. Well, why was the lens dry? Aha! Now, that led me in a dry eye. And that led me into 10 years working with artificial tear-like substitutes, solutions or other products that you could put on the eye. And today, as a result of the work that I did in the 1990s, there's three products in the market that I either invented or I was a co-inventor of. And I brought in this entire field of lipid technology. And I thought that would solve all dry eye. Well, guess what? It helped, but it can solve all. So now you make the observation, it can solve all. And your intellectual curiosity says, why? And that led to me discovering the fact that there's a problem called meibomian gland dysfunction, which we named, our team named that, going way, way back, 1980, I believe. And we named that. And then as the years have gone by, with more and more observation, with more and more research, with more and more curiosity, we have found out that it's the basis, it's the root cause of the majority of all dry eye. And 15 more years of work in that area has led me to the conclusion that a whole definition of dry eye is wrong. And that's what I'm working on today. Getting back to your original question, which was, why do you still practice? If a person comes in and said, my eyes just tear so badly, and you look at them, and they say, can't stand it. I can't go outside. I can't stand outside. I can't drive a car in the winter or in the summer. If I have air conditioning on or if I have the defroster blowing in my face, it's terrible. I can barely drive. When you see that from the patient and you hear it from the patient, it brings an entirely different dimension than having somebody else do the work, writing up a beautiful paper and presenting it to you. You have no idea of the magnitude of it. And again, we have to get motivated. We have to be believers ourselves that there is a problem if we're going to solve it. We have to be motivated. We have to have a passion. So that's why I do it. And I enjoy it. And I enjoy helping people. Fun.
What's on the horizon for dry eye?
What's on the horizon for dry eye? There will be a lot of products which are ineffective because they're based on a model which doesn't pay tribute to the root causes of dry eye. If individuals design the best possible formulations to suppress inflammation, new steroids which don't cause glaucoma or cataracts or have other side effects, and on and on and on, you'd think that would do it. But inflammation is a sequela. It's not a root cause. Inflammation is the only response that the body can have, understanding that inflammation covers a broad spectrum of responses of the body at different levels. So there'll be multiple failures, but again, hope rings eternal, and marketing is great, and they will be marketed, and they will be financially successful, even as many of the products on the market are today, but they will not provide a great deal of long-term relief to the majority of people because they don't address the root cause. But the hope is that with the passing of time and the expression of different ideas by those who think, most people would say, in quotes, outside of the box, or they have different ideas. But in reality, they're just more considered ideas. Various companies will take a path to better fund efforts to approach the root cause. And there's primarily a limited number of root causes of dry eye. There's immune causes, there's special causes, there's locational causes. And the big cause today for the majority of dry eye is not Sjogren's disease. It's not these rare diseases which cause it. It's not rheumatoid arthritis. It's the electronic device world we're living in, which inhibits blinking. So it's a broad spectrum area of human behavior which has to be changed. And if you understand the anthropological model, the human being, Homo sapiens, is not designed to engage in activities for more than minutes, which inhibit the blinking. And there are at least 100 articles which clearly show that being on electronic devices inhibits blinking. So if individuals have the intellectual curiosity and they make the right observations, and they collaborate with those who know more than they do, someone will be able to listen to all this and put together the right team to verify the problem and then develop a task force to solve the problem. So this whole electronic age coming about has wreaked havoc on maintaining the appropriate tear film on the eye, so we don't have this cascade, which we just call dry eye.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
That is a very, very interesting question. That sort of staggers me. They probably don't know that as a youth I was a wild man. Well, I participated in many things that, looking back, were just insane. I mean, I don't think many of my colleagues would believe that I would be attempting to become a water ski jumper, at which I was not successful, although my brother was successful. I have a kid brother who became a very accomplished water ski jumper, holding world records for limited amounts of time, et cetera, et cetera. But I enjoyed those type of things as a youth. So that's something they probably don't know about me. They probably also, Terry is in the room, they probably also would, you know, that I've mentored many people, mm-hmm. both professionals and minorities.
Yes.
And they probably don't know that. And for a period of about 10 years, Terry, maybe 15 years, I mentored African-American children.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some great successes and I had some failures. One of the great successes I had was the object of a Pulitzer Prize book called A Hope in the Unseen.
What's his name?
His name is Cedric Jennings, J-E-N-N-I-N-G-S. Some of the work that I did with him was instrumental in him raising his academic credentials to the point where he was admitted to Brown University. And from there on, he has a master's in education from Harvard, and another master's from University of Michigan in another form related to education, and now is pursuing a PhD at Ohio State. So I'm very proud of what I contributed with him, and I'm very glad for him. So I guess that's something most people don't know I've done. I love the water, and I sail. I sail with my son. He's a good sailor. I am not a good sailor because I didn't learn as a child. But as a youth, when I was 12, 13, 14, I was rather wild, and I did manage to get myself in a few situations where I actually had the opportunity to race boats for a while. So I did some interesting things at a superficial level, not a accomplished level.
What's your guilty pleasure food?
All foods. Greek yogurt?
That patient brings in?
Oh, yeah,
that's
yeah.
So good.
Yeah. Several kinds of yogurt, I think, are really spectacular. But I have a problem that I have to confess, and it fits back into the anthropological model, and it's one of the things that interested me when I was a child. I can go extended periods of time without eating, as I can tell you. I can go a day or 2 days without eating. It doesn't bother me at all. But once I eat anything, I find it very difficult to stop eating. According to those who are great anthropologists, what that means, supposedly, is that I come from a certain part of Europe where 9 or 10 months a year, there would be nothing to eat on the trees or berries or crops. And then they were hunters. You would wait until someone killed a large animal in your little tribe, and then you'd gouge yourself because you didn't know when the next meal was coming. So my anthropological friends tell me that's what that's due to. My wife is just the opposite. She has to eat every 3 to 4 hours. She has to have something to eat. Not much, just a little bit. And they say that that's a clear indication that they're berry pickers. So I'm not an expert in that area.
Do you have any regrets?
If I had one regret, I think it would be that I was brought up in a house that did not place financial success as something that should be even considered. That accumulating money was not something that you should even think about. And that it was probably wrong. It was probably wrong. You should just, as long as you had enough to eat and have a reasonable life and educate your children. That's all you needed. And I think that in retrospect, I don't have regret about it, but I don't think that's correct, in that if I had the resources that I should have for what I developed and invented, which involved billions of dollars of products, and I don't, you know, I didn't really financially benefit to any degree from them. When I say to any degree, yes, there's some benefit, but it's not of a benefit which can allow me to be a great philanthropist. But when you look at the opportunities that money will allow, I think that the people who work with you are entitled to far more than they can be paid. And I think if you had unlimited money, you could do that, and you'd feel a lot better about yourself, and you could also fund your own research better and not be out looking for money all the time. And the way to understand what researchers have to do is to understand politicians. Politicians today have to spend 75% or more of their time raising money. That's what they spend. And if they don't, they don't get elected. That's not a good situation, is it? So if you're doing research and you want to be funded by NIH and the National Eye Institute, you have to write up all of this information, and you spend for, in a year, you could easily spend anywhere between 1 and 4 months doing nothing but writing up your presentation for funding. So having resources, you can do just so much outside of buy a yacht or outside of buy whatever else, buy a 25,000 square foot home or all the things that most of us don't need and we're better off without. So I don't know whether that explains it. It's very, very difficult to articulate. But I would think that might well be the price I paid being brought up in a household was just not to consider money important. As long as you had what you needed at the time, that was wonderful.
How should optometry move forward?
I would think that optometry has, in the past 10 years, shouldered its responsibilities. And its responsibilities are to be a primary eye care profession and provide care that is outside of the surgical culture. We have evolved into this electronic age. Visual function is more and more important. And we have to maintain that. And the tendency is there's only so many things you can do well. So optometry will have to develop different specialties. But again, someone has to pay for all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, who is going to pay for this? Is society willing to say, let's suppose methods evolve which are rehabilitation, either in dry eye or in visual function, or what other areas are really rehabilitative areas rather than medical problems, which can be cured by surgery or cured by medications. Who's going to pay for this? How is it going to be funded? How is it going to break down? And I don't have the answer for any of that. So I think if we look out 20 years from now, despite the insurance problems, despite the payment, despite everything, the field will have to evolve to do what's right for society. Ultimately, that always happens. It's just a question of how long it takes, what the impediments are, what the shackles are that constrain us. But I really think that has to happen. So I don't know how well that answers your question, but...
What would you like your legacy to optometry to be?
I don't think that way. I don't really, you know, it's legacies are mainly ego, and I've learned a long time ago from my studies of Russian philosophy from the 1850s to 1900 that's a bad question. And let me tell you a model that might be helpful. In that period of time, they had stage coaches. And the best stage coaches had between 12 and 16 horses. And they were operated by usually one driver, one brakeman, and one lookout. A gentleman named Ouspensky, who was a Russian philosopher, posed the question, what would happen if instead of having one driver for the 12 or 16 horses, you had 12 or 16 drivers, so the driver for every horse? And the answer, of course, is chaos, particularly if one wanted to go left, one wanted to go right, one wanted to stop, one wanted to trot, one wanted to gallop, and one wanted to go full speed, etc. Ouspensky taught from that model that if you considered each one of the drivers as a separate ego, and you made an analog to the human, and the human had 12 or 16 different egos, one of love, one of hate, one of passion, one of egomania, one of inferiority, one of superiority. They had all these different egos that they had to battle with. What would happen? And the answer is you'd have chaos. You'd have a very unsettled human being, and you'd just have absolute chaos. So relative to a legacy, you'd have to look at Ouspensky's model and say, what do you really want? And the only thing you should really want is that whatever you did provided some help for society when you did it, and hopefully a basis for others to obsolete what you did. So that's what I would say I would want.
Now we're at our last question, and I inflict this one on everybody. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
The craziest thing that I've ever done is to have the audacity that I could solve problems that had never been solved. I think something which is crazy, you have to define what crazy is. And the way I would casually define it is a crazy act is something which has an unreasonably low probability of success and could be catastrophic to the individual. If you ask me, when did I recognize that this was crazy?
Let's go with that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I never did. You know, to me, my passion just overruled. I wasn't in control of the various eyes within me. The eye that wanted to do this, the ego that thought I could solve that, the positive aspect overcame all of the cautionary areas in my brain, which I should have had for self-preservation. I mean, when an individual believes that they can tackle something which is complicated, which they don't really understand completely, but they have a model for, so they say, this is what we have to do, but they have no idea of anything else. They do understand it's going to cost a lot of money. They don't have any idea of how much time it is. They don't have any idea of how many people they'll have to recruit. They have no idea of any of these things. But what they do know is that it's never been done before. No one's ever done it. No one's ever been able to solve that problem. And now you go ahead and you say, I'm going to solve it. I'm going to tackle this. You don't really have the resources, and you don't have many of the other factors which are needed, but yet you have confidence in yourself or the excitement of doing such a thing. It's so exciting to you that your rational judgment is subject. I think that's probably the way to express it. So So I said, that's crazy. And it is crazy. It really is crazy.
But you're glad you did it anyway.
Oh yeah, it was great. I mean, it was great. It was so exciting. I mean, it was just wonderful. And the excitement lasted 4 or 5 years. And the worst thing, by the way, about research to me is when you're successful, the excitement's gone. I really border on depression when you complete, because it's all over. It's done.
Well, Dr. Korb, that is all the questions I have for you today, and thank you for helping me make this interview come together.
Well, you're superb at what you do, I will say that. I actually enjoy being with you.